I'm going to laugh and smile this whole entire episode.
Well,
because,
you're going to get it right back.
Well, I tell you, one of my heroes is here with me. None of you guys can see it right now. You guys can't see him, but you're about to meet one of my heroes. My dad, when we moved to Florida, he pulled me outside. I got some chicken skin right now because he pulled me outside, I got you something to listen to, son. And he hit me with what would change my life and shape my musical love forever and also the world's forever. He showed me this song, and this song was, I'm the M-A-S, the T-E-R, the G with the double E, and I go by the unforgettable name of the man I call him Master G. And it just hit me. And it was my first introduction to hip-hop. It was my connection to my pops, who you guys know how much I love my pops. And here on the show today, I have none other than Master G, the man, the myth, the godfather of hip-hop, the foundation, and the very first to ever do it. Welcome to the show, Master G.
What's up, Kelly? How you doing, brother?
Hey, my permagrin is here already, man.
Yeah,
and,
well, you know how we feel. You know how I feel about you, brother. You know that.
I want to tell you, the time that we got to spend together, you performed at Secret Knock, which was unbelievable, brought down the house. But afterwards, you were walking out to the curb, you and John walking out to the curb, and I just said, hey, man, I don't want to bother, but I'm going to dinner. And you just looked at me and you said, give me 10 minutes. And I said, no big deal. You said, give me 10 minutes. I went to the restaurant. You showed up. We got to break bread for two hours.
Which I never do. You got to put that in the equation, which I never do. After a show, I'm a ghost. Yeah. But I knew you would have gotten. I knew your energy was right.
Thank you. Gee, everyone knows Sugar Hill. Everybody on the planet. We were just talking about my buddy Craig. Can you give a quick shout out to Craig? Because he'll kill me if he don't get it. Okay.
Craig, I am humbled. First of all, I want to thank you for your service. Because part of the reason I'm able to travel this globe is because of the military. They know, don't mess with no American passport. Don't mess with no American, because the military is coming to get that booty. So thank you for my life, and I appreciate you thinking I was important enough to be a part of yours.
Well, help me with this, because everybody knows that story. The story that I want to talk about is humility, is patience, is traveling across the country, knocking on doors with sunglasses, a hat in disguise. Hit 'em, G.
So 79, we came out. 79 to 85 was the for that phase, that block. In 1985, things had gone really bad, really, really bad. I kind of found out that it wasn't like it needed to be. I was 23. I had a little boy. I had no high school diploma. I dropped out of school to do Sugar Hill. And I'm a winner, not a chicken dinner. And so I had to figure out a way. So kind of by osmosis, I found this ad in the newspaper that said free to travel. And because I was a traveler already, I didn't know that it was going to be door to door, you know, but it said they represent leader publications. So I went for the interview, and what happened was it was a door to door sales company. And so that's what I did. So from 1985 to 1989, almost 3 years, I knocked on doors from one end of the United States to the other in the rain, in the snow, in the winter, and selling books and magazines. Yeah. Books, magazines, and Bibles. Books, Bibles, and magazines.
But G, talk to me too about, like, you told me that you were scared that people were going to notice you because, I mean, you were the big, at that time, you were the biggest act in the world. In the world.
Yes. So that was the history. That was the problem. Yeah. You know, my thing was because, so you got to take it in context. And, you know, we talked about this too when we ate. During that time, hip hop hadn't, you know, mushroomed into what it became. So there wasn't a lot of movie opportunities and television shows, LL Cool J, Ice Cube, all these things that happened later on. During that time, you toured and you recorded. That's all you did, you know. So I'm thinking, you know, the only way for me to reinvent myself or get my life back together was to find something else. But with that being said, I was still the hottest teenager in the country, you know what I mean? So You know, every day that I went door to door, I wrestled with the possibility that somebody might recognize me. And, you know, like, what in the hell are you doing? You know, I mean, you know, because there's not very many black guys named Guy O'Brien from New York City. You know what I mean?
You did have a run in, though, where a guy went in.
I did.
Talk to me about this, because this blew my mind.
We were in Florida, and I was doing my thing. It was my, you know, normally out on territory, knocking on doors, going door to door. I hit the door. You know, I have an intro. Hey, my name is Guy O'Brien. I'm with the, you know, the big work program in the area. And the guy stopped me. He's like, whoa, wait, what'd you say your name was? I said, Guy, you know, Guy O'Brien. I'm still trying to be, you know, the kid in the contest. That was the program. That was the sales conversation. You kid in the contest, working to win $1,000 and get a promotion in the company. He said, well, Guy O'Brien, wait a minute, hold up. And he said, he went in the house and came back out with a Sugar Hill record. And he was like, Guy O'Brien, there's not too many black guys by the name of Guy O'Brien. I know who you are, man. I was like, oh, boy. But the truth always works. I told him the deal. I said, you know, as a matter of fact, that particular conversation helped me shape the conversation that I pretty much gave to people. And I said, you know, when I was young, I made a lot of money when I was young, but you know, young people and money, they part company quickly. I said, so what I'm doing now is I'm learning how to develop the ability to build businesses and also inspire and help other young people to not make the same mistakes that I made. I made the conversation up right there at that door. And when I did that, he was like, oh, okay, yeah. And it all made sense. I said, so, you know, I'm starting all over again. I'm working my way from the bottom to the top. And, you know, I'm getting people to show. I'm showing the company that I can get results through conversation. And how do you think I'm doing so far? And the guy was like, you're doing great. And he ended up buying an order from me. So, yeah. But the whole time, my heart was like, boom, 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 boom. This is great. What am I doing? Oh, my God. So, yeah.
So take us back to this birthplace of hip hop. Now, you're so humble. When I said it at Secret Knock and I said that you're the godfather of hip hop and rap, you were like, oh, no, there's a lot before me.
Yeah. But
you were the one that put it on the map because we had never heard anything like this before. How old are you? Take us through that part of it. How old are you when it starts to happen? And did you realize that you literally were going to be the foundation for every commercial, every Super Bowl ad?
No. So first of all, there was nothing written. There was nothing televised. There was nothing recorded to get me prepared for what my life has become. Nothing. I mean, nothing. Early 70s, 77, 76, 77, I was 15, 16 years old. I was a high school kid in Hackensack, New Jersey. I was looking for a way to make extra money. I was in Round Studio Audio Equipment. I'd seen another guy that was older than me doing parties in our area in Hackensack. So I got with my buddy and I was like, hey man, we can make extra money, you know, by doing a DJ thing ourselves. So I just started out initially playing music, you know, and then I went to this party that the same guy that I saw DJing, I heard him at a party one night and he was talking over the music. So I had a little bit of a reputation for doing parties, but I knew him well, and his name was Mark Green. As a matter of fact, I still know him. He's still a buddy, and he's actually booked shows for me now, which is a wild story anyway. Yeah, he owns a booking agency, and now we've done some. As a matter of fact, he's booking a show for us right now somewhere in Connecticut. Anyway, so I go to him. I said, Mark, you know, what was that you were doing? So Mark was a couple of years older than me. So he said, hey, man, that's rapping. That's what they're doing in New York. So you got to remember, this is 76, 77, when there was no internet, there was no social media, there was none of this. It was all word of mouth. And because he was older than me, he was able to go to New York. My mother wasn't letting me, 15-year-old me, hang out in New York. Anyway, so I heard him talking. He said, that's rapping. And what I heard was poetry, because he was rhyming every word. He was rhyming the words of each sentence. Because I'm a drummer, I heard the beats. So I said, okay, basically, this is rhythmic poetry. And I said, okay, in order for me to get parties, I'm going to have to learn. You know, you got to deal with the competition. You got to do what the competition's doing. We're talking about, this is a 16-year-old kid, you know, thinking about dealing with the competition and hedging my opportunities and all this. I'm like, okay, in order for me to do more parties, I got to do what this cat's doing because that looks like the thing. And that's how I started rapping, literally. You know, I literally started rapping so that I could get more parties, which I was getting paid $50 to do a house party and $100 to do a dance hall. So if I did like a VFW, I got $100 for that. If I did like your basement party on the weekend on Saturday night, I got $50 for that. Though we know now that it's drastically different. But that was the deal. And so that's what happened. So I started doing it, and I was doing it in, you know, Hackensack. And then my mom ended up moving to Englewood, New Jersey, because all this was happening in the northern New Jersey area, Bergen County. So I get to Englewood, and I, again, you know, I convinced a girl to throw a party in Englewood, because again, there's no word of mouth. There's no, I mean, there's no social media. There's none of this to advertise, not, you know. So I convinced this girl to throw a party at her house. She was popular in school in Englewood, and that's how everybody got to see me talk, rap, and play music. And I started DJing in Englewood, and that's how I got discovered. So being in Englewood, I was walking down on Main Street, and there was a car parked in front of the pizza parlor. In front of the pizza parlor was a woman named Sylvia and her son Joey. And the long and short of it is they were listening to the big guy from New York who made pizzas was rapping, which was Hank. My friend, which is another guy named Mark Green, which is wild. Yeah, two different Mark Greens. One showed me rapping, one got me discovered. Tells the people that, oh, no, if you want to hear somebody rap, you got to listen to my friend. And he was talking to me. I'm standing, you know, just there hanging out. So I got in the back of the car, and as far as we knew, it was going to be one person. We, you know, because the way they were saying it was going to be one person. We ended up going up to her house. Mike came up also. She had heard him on a tape earlier, but she decided not to use him. So I thought I was going back and forth with Hank. She didn't decide, and we were getting all, ready to leave. Mike says, well, Miss Robinson, I know you heard me on the tape, but I had a cold that day. Could you hear me? Could you listen to me? And she says, well, okay, about 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, he goes off. You know, he does his thing, and that's what happened. She said, well, you know what? Three is my favorite number. I'm not going to choose between the three of you. I'm going to put the three of you together. And that's how the Sugar Hill Gang was formed.
So tell me, too, about, like, there's a lot of people who are rapping nonsense, talk about things that they don't do. But I didn't know that Rapper's Delight was actually, the lyrics that you were talking about were real. Like that.
Yeah.
So take me through that, because this blew my mind.
Right. So you got to, again, we're talking about the first commercially successful rap record ever. So the record that we knew that, and there was no video. So that's the other thing. There was no video that supported the song. There was none of that. We wrote the raps like an author writes a book. And I talk about this a lot. You know, like if you read a book, you say, if you're talking about you, right, Kelly, you say, well, Kelly had a smile that lit up the sky, and he has, you know, gold locks in his hair, and his eyebrows are, you know, statuesque. And the whole, so you make sure through words a person knows what you're talking about. So Mike, being the genius that he was, there was a show called Outer Limits back in those days. And he took that. It said, don't attempt to adjust your dial. This is not a test. What you hear is not a test. Well, what are you doing? We're rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, because now I want you to know there's more than just me. Now me, the groove, and my friends are going to try to move your feet. Well, who are you? Well, I'm Wonder Mike. And I want to say hello. To who? To the black, the white, the red, and the brown, the purple and yellow. You know, and then you go on, and he says, okay, there's some more, so far I've heard my voice. So far you heard my voice, but I brought a few friends along. Next on the mic is my man Hank. Come on, Hank, sing that song. Now we jumped. Hank does his thing. Now it's me. So now I'm thinking, okay, I got to let people know, out of the three of us, who I am. So I'm going to make sure people know my name. So I'm going to spell my name. I'm the M-A-S, the T-E-R, the G with a double E. I go by the unforgettable name of the man they call the Master G. Now, I'm 17 years old. I'm in high school. I'm really trying to get, you know, the beautiful girls. Now, here goes the lies. My name is known all over the world. I'm going down in history as the best rapper that could ever be. My name is known all over the world by all the foxy ladies and the pretty girls. No, hell no, it wasn't. No, it was not. You know, I'm the baddest rapper that ever did it, all of that. No. So then the other thing is, I wanted everybody to know who I was in size. I guess by now you could take a hunch and find that I'm the baby of the bunch, but that's okay. Still keeping stride, because all I'm here to do is just wiggle your behind. I'm going back to the girls.
Yes.
So all of those lyrics, you know, including the 12 o'clock rap, all of those lyrics were designed for people to know who we were. And so it was all, you know, stuff that we wanted to happen, things that were happening and things that, you know, we wanted people to know about us.
My friend Will, my best friend in the world, when I told him you were going to be on the show and when I got to interview at Secret Knock, he said, ask him if the chicken really tastes like wood.
So
that's were you guys capping on somebody's food?
That was a true story. So Mike, that's Mike's rap. Have you ever been over a friend's house to eat and the food just ain't good? The macaroni soggy, peas all mushy, the chicken tastes like wood. He went to a barbecue. It was his girlfriend's house. So it was not a friend. It was really a girlfriend. But he changed it to friend so he wouldn't offend the girlfriend. But that is a true story. He went to the barbecue. He said the food, it literally, that's what, the way he said it, is the way it, and you got to know Mike. So like, if you know Mike is like the funniest guy on the planet. Like I was talking to him the other day. He just says the wildest things in the world. And he's so smart, you know, like he's so smart and he's such a master at the English language, you know. So the way that he uses words, and he's funny. So he's a funny guy that knows how to use the English language. So imagine what that's like. And that's why he wrote that rap.
So you guys record, right?
Yeah.
Do you already know that you're going to bring together? Because when he said the black, the white, the you know, purple and yellow, did you guys already foresee or know that everyone was going to listen to your music?
No. That's why I keep trying. I try to, you know, it's like, again, the best way that I've been trying to describe this to people is there was space travel. We knew about space travel, but life did not become what it became until Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. Okay? Nobody knew what it was going to be till that moment. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So literally, we were just doing what we knew inwardly. So when he said, you know, I want to say hello, he said, I'm going to say hello. I'm saying hello to everybody. And because we were, you know, kids that had been, you know, we lived amongst everybody. So in that area, we lived amongst, you know, whites and blacks and Spanish. And, you know, so that's why he said that, you know, because, you know, we just were people that were used to being around a lot of people. But we never realized. Mike said he knew the record was going to be big, but he didn't know it was going to be what it became. So he thought it was just going to be a big record. Like, you know, I thought it was going to be only heard in the New York metropolitan area. I thought New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, they were going to get it. It was going to make me popular when I went back to school. Because mind you got to keep this in mind too. I was in this, it was the summer of the 11th grade going to the 12th grade. So I recorded the record before I was going to my senior year in high school. So I'm thinking the record's going to come out. I'm going to have the best senior year in high school ever. You know what I mean? I'm going to be getting dates like crazy. I'm going to get parties like nobody's business. And I'm going to go into the rest of my life with this little bit of, you know, 15 minutes of fame. And that's going to be that. I was totally wrong. That was not the case, you know. So again, it was all just like divine intervention on everything that, you know, like even the part where I'm saying my name is known all over the world by all the Fox ladies and the pretty girls. I didn't really think that was true. I didn't think that was going to happen. But evidently, my spirit must have known it was happening because I said it. I wrote it, you know.
So you guys, you guys get on the road and you're opening up for George Clinton, right? And then things start to roll and then you become the headliner. Who do you bring on at this time?
Oh, so we start working with everybody, man. We were on the road with anybody, you name it, from Cameo to the Barclays and every R&B group that was doing anything at that time. Zap, we performed with Zap. We performed with Kool & Gang. We performed with any group that you could imagine that was out during that time, we were on the road with it. And the other thing is, we were the only rap act on the bill. So you might have a show like Kool & Gang, Zap, and, you know, I don't know, Evelyn King and Sugar Hill Gang. You know what I mean? Like, we were the only rap act on it because nobody really, in the first couple of years, it was only just us on the road. You know, Mel and Scorpion didn't come out. You know, Furious Five and all of that didn't come out until a little bit after Rapid's Light had blown up. So the first, like, year or so, we were the only rap act out there.
Period. Wow. And then when you guys started to headline, who did you bring on?
So we did, we used to do this thing called the Sugar Hill Review. So we brought all of the acts from Sugar Hill on the road, like the Motown, like Motown had the Motown Review back in the day.
Yeah.
Mr. Gordy, who is actually somebody that I revere and know, have known for quite a while. So shout out to Mr. Gordy. Anybody that knows that Mr. Gordy knew my brother, Leo. So shout out to Mr. Gordy. But they had this thing called the Motown Review. And so they had all their acts and they would go out on the road and they would do, you know, they do the tour. So that's what eventually ended up happening. We had a thing called the Sugar Hill Review and we headlined. So it would be like Funky Four Plus One More, The Sequence, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And of course the headline act would be Sugar Hill Gang. And we played arenas. We was doing like civic centers and that kind of thing.
And you didn't realize when you went to Europe and you started getting outside the country, just how big this thing had gotten. Am I correct?
Yeah. Well, then so you go into the United States of America where it was word of mouth information, you know, like a cat. Like I talked to somebody not too long ago and they were like, they had a friend that like was on the East Coast and then he went out to Seattle with a tape, you know, and they heard like people rapping on the tape. So there was indications of it, you know, in different pockets of this country, but nobody had physically seen somebody rap until me, Mike, and Hank came to that country. So like the first time that anybody in the Netherlands had ever seen somebody rap was me, Mike, and Hank. Now they had heard the record had broke by that time and we didn't even realize how big we actually were, you know. So in the Netherlands and France and all these different countries, we're like, you know, huge. You know, we're doing England. We did the one of the biggest shows called Top of the Pops. You probably heard of it before. But you know, we did Top of the Pops in a wave pool, you know what I mean? And like this thing still plays to this day, this Top of the Pops. But the fact that nobody had physically seen it made it even more of a like a meteoric event when we came to these countries because we were in their determination, we were the ones that created the damn thing. So we weren't just artists, we were inventors too, which wasn't the case. But you know, to the German kid in Munich, you know, who's seeing this thing for the first time live, you know, he's looking at Henry Ford, you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
So when you get in that place, I mean, obviously you're young because you're, at this time, you're 19 years old?
Yeah, 19, yeah.
Okay.
By that time, yeah. So, 18 going on 19, yeah.
So at that time, obviously, when you're 19 years old, you have a ton of wisdom. You take things slow. You don't move fast. I'm just joking with you. But at 19, this becomes invincibility, right? Because you're touring the world. Nobody could tell you nothing.
No, I'm hotter than fish grease. You know what I'm saying? I'm the most popular teenager on the planet. Period. At 18, 19 years old, and I'm wigging out because I went from being, you know, not thinking I was accepted as a kid because my mom had me and was, you know, I had stepdads and, you know, trying to make my way because I wasn't the guy that had the car in high school and trying to figure out my way in the parents' book. I went from all of that weirdness, okay, to girls screaming and crying and having to have bodyguards and, you know, being shuttled and having decoys running one way so I could go another way and being, you can't even hear me over the screens when I'm trying to do my lyrics. 19.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm trying to, and you know, I try to tell people this all the time. Fortunately, my mother was a very interesting person. And I think that she was grooming me. Gave me independence. Then she also taught me how to be my own individual. And so even with that, I was still wigging out, but I think the reason why my head didn't explode is because I had those basic fundamentals to kind of navigate it with. So it wasn't as bad as it could have been as a result of that, but it was crazy. Yeah, well, I had to many times believe that, you know, and what I did is I think we might've talked about this before. I came up with the fact that Master G and Guy O'Brien have to live in two different worlds. Right. So I realized that Master G can't live in the real world and Guy O'Brien can't live in the performing world because Guy O'Brien is more laid back, reserved to himself, low key, wannabe. Master G is out there off the top. He's the ladies' man. He's this, he's that, he's fly. He's, you know, And he can't live in the day to day because he thinks he walks on water. And, you know, nobody walks on water. There's only one person like that. So, yeah.
But take us to this time, because at that height, when you're going and hot as fish grease, can nobody tell you anything? There's never a time that you would have even thought that you would lose your name or somebody would take your name.
No, I didn't. I thought I had finally figured it out. I mean, you know, I went through a very interesting childhood where I never felt like I belonged, and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And I was like, you know, I was thinking about going into the military. I wasn't a college kind of person. So I knew I wouldn't want to do college. So I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? And then bam, you know, I'm on stage one night and I'm like, oh wow, this is my calling. I get it now. This is my thing. You know, so I figured out I got my thing. So I got my thing and I'm good to go. And this thing is working and it's on and it's popping and I'm doing it and it can't get any better. And then all of a sudden I just woke up one day and it was not happening anymore. So, you know, what actually happened is it didn't really dawn on me till much later that I couldn't be myself. So that's where we go to 85. So 85. When I started realizing that all of these things weren't what they appeared to be, my fame was, this is what I tell people all the time. Like, you could lose every dime that you made. You could lose every asset that you have, possession you have, but you can never not be famous once you're famous. Think about that. So, and being famous with, you know, Maseratis and $1 million homes and, you know, chauffeurs and being famous, beautiful clothes and, you know, being famous like that is great. But being famous when you're flat broke and you're walking is a whole nother life reality. Yeah. Yeah. Like when people are used to seeing you rolling down the street in a $100,000 car and you sitting at the bus stop, it's a different reality now. See, you can never get away from fame. No, never, ever, ever, ever. Once you're famous. You'll be famous. The day I die, they will never say, they won't say Guy O'Brien, except that person passed away. They're going to say Guy O'Brien, founding member of Sugar Hill Gang, professionally known as Master G, passed away today. That's the deal. So this is what I had to deal with. You see what I'm saying? Once I had to get away, I had to leave the situation. Because I couldn't fix what I didn't know, what I knew not to be right, I couldn't fix it. But begin with the foundation, I was willing to take the humiliation of having to start at the bottom all over again and build myself up in the midst of that fame. So that's what happened. So I went from 85 to 2005 and fortunately built a multi-million dollar business doing that, you know. So by 2005, my friend and best friend to this day, still Wonder Mike, which we always stayed in contact with, he called me in 2005, was like, look, man, I'm not dealing with the company anymore because we had an agreement. Like my agreement was whatever he ever wanted to do, as long as he wasn't going to do it with them, I would do it with him. And that's what happened. It took longer than we thought, 20 years. But wow. 2005, he called me. And I thought he just called just to say what's up or get some money because I helped him out throughout the years. He's come seeing my businesses, all of that. He knew that I was doing well. He's like, man, I left the company. I'm not with the company anymore. I was like, what? What are you talking about? He's like, yeah, I'm not with the company. He said, but there's some people out here and they want to do something, but they won't do it unless you're involved. And at this point, I had built my business up to a point where I was about to retire. I was going to retire in Phoenix and play golf and work out. That was going to be my goal. Like I had done enough. You know, I had a family and businesses and people and all this other stuff. And I was like, okay, you know what? And I fell in love with golf and working out. So I was like, okay, I was almost like going close to almost being 50 at the time. I was like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to, you know, take it easy. And then I go end up with him. I meet these people and they're like, we want to do this thing. I'm like, we're like, okay. So what happened in that 20-year span was that the person that took over the group had 20 years of full reign. But when I came back onto the scene, we started to rival that reign, and that pissed them off. And in the process of them pissing them off, we found out that they had trademarked our personal name, stage name, they had trademarked the group name. And so they put us in a position where every time we would do a show, every time we would book a show, their people would send cease and desist. They would threaten to sue. They sued people that booked shows for us. And this went on from 2005 to 2010. We had to deal with that. In 2010, we went into what we thought was a settlement agreement, but the settlement agreement was literally set up to fail. And the only thing that we got out of that settlement agreement when they knew it was going to fail was the trademarks to our personal stage names, but we had to give up the name Sugar Hill Gang. Now, Sugar Hill Gang is always going to be a part of who we are, so you can talk about it in history, but we couldn't use it to advertise or promote anything. So let's say you want to book me to come to your town and play at your theater, right? Whatever the theater is, you couldn't say Sugar Hill Gang is coming to their town, even though I'm there to perform. You had to, we went under the name Rappers Delight for a while. We were trying that.
Yeah.
And then over in Europe, because European law and American law is two different things, we were former members of, original members of. We were doing all of that, but again, all of that got stripped away from us. And we had to rebrand ourselves. We had to rebrand ourselves Rappers Delight.
Take me to 1985. When did you start to understand that things were not as what they seemed? Because most people out here, we think, oh, you hit a hit record, you're touring all over the world, everything's good. You're literally on your gold road to heaven. You know what I mean? That's what as a kid, when my dad showed me from the boombox with the D batteries, 18 of them in the boombox, I thought, Master J, I mean, that's it.
Yeah, Sugar Hill's great. We're wonderful. So and that's what I'm saying. So I lived the life of a successful recording artist. I mean, I had beautiful places and I had wonderful jewelry and I had cars and this and that, and I was on television. And so I had that success, but there were things that I started finding out as I got more knowledgeable about the business of my business, that I wasn't being compensated properly. There were things that weren't, you know, in my favor, merchandising and all these different things. And so I started becoming educated. So by the time I got to the end of my contract, they wanted me to resign, and I was not going to resign without a renegotiation. And that's when we bumped heads. So they were like, no, you sign and we're going to do all these things. And at that point, I was, like I said, I was around 23 years old, and I kind of was always my own person. And I was like, no, I've been with you guys 5 years, because it was a 3 year contract with a 2 year option. That's how it ended up being to 85. So 79 to 83, and then 84, 85, they took both options. And I was like, no, we're going to negotiate this thing. And once we do that, you know, then I'll sign. And then they was like, no. And I told them to kiss my ass and I walked out. You know, I was like, cause I couldn't fix it at the time. I didn't have the resources to fix it. This was just me. Literally, I was in there trying to negotiate my own contract, renegotiate my contract, no lawyers, no representation, nothing. I'm just in there, because at this point, my son had been born by the niece of Sylvia. The woman, basically, I thought she was like another mother to me. I figured that I could go in there, you know, and say, look, we know each other. You know my track record. You know I'm dependable, reliable, this and that. We can do this. And, you know, business is business, you know, at the end of the day, you know. Business is black and white. It is what it is, you know. And I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to stand for this, you know. And like I said, you know, if you don't stand for something, you go for anything. And I'm not the one to go for anything. So I walked out and I went on this trek, man. And that's how we ended up, you know, having to deal with it. Because once I left, they were like, okay. And then they had a resurge in the 90s. Yeah. They had like released a record. Overseas, that did a remix of Rappers Delight in the Netherlands. They did this remix and that kind of blew a spark. And then they started getting calls again to do shows. So they were going out on the road, but I was not a part of it, you know. And here's another thing. I don't know if we talked about this, but so like in early 89, they had an offer to go to France and do a tour in France. I was about at the threshold of starting my business now, the magazine thing. And they called me up. They're like, you know, gee, we got this tour. And I had been with the magazine people about 3-4 years at the point. I was like a field supervisor, like I said, getting ready stuff. And they were like, you know, we need you to come on back, man, and come to France. Now, this is my thing now. You got to remember, you know, me and Master G was my thing. You know, I went door to door and was driving people around because I had to hustle and went to make money, you know. And I said, okay, well, you know what? Let me think about this. So, again, I'm right on the verge of starting my own sales organization. And at the same time, now I'm being offered my thing again. Yeah. At the same exact time. And I sat, man, and I never forget this. And I said to myself, I said, because I had seen people in this magazine thing leave and come back. And they would leave, or whatever, they would come back, they would have to start all over from the beginning to earn the people's trust. And so what I said was, when nobody else cared about me, these magazine people brought me in and they gave me an opportunity to build my life back and get myself together. And I'm getting ready to start my own business, whereas I'll be calling my own shots. Nobody will ever be able to dictate to me what I'm going to do. As much as I love doing my thing, I don't think that that's the right place for me to be, because I still have no control over that. And I made the decision to start the business. What was the best decision I made? Because 89, I started it in 89, 90. By 94, I had made, you know, I had made a fortune. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they were blown away, because I was like, no, I'm not coming. They were like, you what? What do you mean? You know, I'm on the phone talking to them. I'm like, no, I'm good. I'm gonna stay where I'm at. Because I believe that the people that in the magazine business really had my back, as opposed to how could we get and do so much? And then I find out that you really didn't have my back, and these people didn't care who I was. You know, I was just like anybody else. They gave, based on my merit, they gave me the ability to be me. So that's kind of what it was, man. I've always had to wrestle with like life-changing decisions.
What's that conversation with God like when, I mean, you're literally for 20 years, you said, you know, from 1985 to 2005. I mean, you're obviously, God's got a larger plan, because he built you as an entrepreneur. Now you understand business. Now you're coming into it completely different. But in the mix, it's good to hear the highlights, G.
Yeah, yeah.
But nobody knows what you were dealing with and the conversation. Like, were you yelling at God? Like, are you kidding me on this?
No, every day, it was a struggle for me to live, because, you know, it was like, how could you do this to me? Like, you know that it was my thing. You saw, you gave it to me to do. You let me know. You hit me to it. And then you just pulled it from underneath me, you know. And so I started doubting, you know, a lot of things. But and you know, the thing that always superseded everything was that I never knew my biological father. Okay, I was raised by stepdads, intelligent Renaissance kind of guys, you know. But I never knew my biological father. So when I had a son, my goal was that, like, I'm not going to do what was done to me. So even on the days that I didn't want to go out there were days, man, that I was knocking on doors that I truly didn't want to be out there. But because of my son, I was motivated. I had to do this. You know what I mean? So I built that whole business and all of that based on the fact that I needed my son to be prouder than me than the street guy. I needed my son to be prouder of me than the drug dealer. So that was my motivation. Now, all the while, I'm wrestling with watching Kumo D, LL Cool J, Ice Cube, all these individuals, because that was during that time. You know, LL started showing up on television, and Modi had done his thing with Wild Wild West, and then Ice Cube started, you know, doing movies and this and that. So I'm looking at this thing happening in front of my eyes. Fortunately, I had a thriving, successful business and a really good life. So, you know, yes, I would be depressed in a Brioni suit and an $80,000 BMW with a Rolex on, you know. But I was still going through, I was depressed. You know, I tell people I was in a very dark place for many, many years, because I really wrestled with, you know, a lot of different highs and lows and peaks and valleys.
Do you now have the Sugar Hill Gang name back?
So we definitely have we have control over the name now. We do everything under the auspices as far as the Sugar Hill Gang is concerned. Live events, merchandising, you name it, we're definitely going full scale with it. And then the other thing is that, and show you how the world works, the family that I fought with, that family changed hands. And so the individual that now runs that family is my business partner. We do phenomenal business together. And he's an amazing individual, Leland Robinson. He's the last remaining family member of that. So it was Joe Robinson, Sylvia Robinson, Joey Robinson, Leland, and Rondo was that immediate family. All of those family members have passed except Leland. And Leland and I, we do business feverishly. So that's why I try to explain to people, yes, there was drama, mm-hmm. but in every adversity lies the seeds to equal a greater benefit. And I've ended up having a better relationship with him than I've ever had with anybody concerning the whole situation, and it only gets better. So you have to go through it to get to it. And if you stay positive, and no matter how crazy, and believe me, it's much easier to be negative than it is positive. But if you can hang in there, you know, if you can hold on, if you can fight through it, if you can go through it, a lot of times, man, you're going to end up on the other side and it's going to be all right. Because I'm a walking testament to that one.
Gee, how many years was it from that point, from the 85 until when you were able to partner with Leland?
It just happened in 2016. Yeah, we didn't go into a partnership until 2016.
So 31 years.
Yeah. I fought and went through this drama. I mean, for many, many years, I was completely, you couldn't even talk to me about Sugar Hill Records, Sugar Hill Gang, nothing. You couldn't play my music. In my house, you couldn't play that. Like my family members, they would all wait till I leave the house and they'd play my songs. But if I came around or something came on the radio or if something showed up, you couldn't do it. I didn't want to hear it. My people, you know, when my salespeople, you know, a lot of times what they would do is they would tell people that I was their boss. You know, they'd go out and tell a customer, you know, who my boss is, blah, blah, blah. And they'd get orders. People would buy for that. But, you know, you couldn't talk to me about it. You might get fired if you ask me about Sugar Hill.
So now, G, what's incredible is you're speaking. People can actually have you at their event to come and do a keynote and not only be able to have the musical aspect, but the reason why I wanted you on the show is because it's, for me, obviously it's foundational.
Yes.
But your story of perseverance, I mean,
yes,
there's very few people that would last 31 years. I mean, hell, most people won't last 31 seconds when they text somebody and they don't text them back. They're already mad.
Yes, yes.
The perseverance, yeah. The hard work, the entrepreneurship, I mean, all those things. They can have you at their Absolutely. Conference. They can have Absolutely. You at their event.
Absolutely. I love it. So this is the thing. And so one of the things that I did, I motivated young people, man, like young people with kind of like tainted backgrounds. They might have had a couple, they might have had like a, you know, few things that they might have did some time or whatever. I hired people that nobody would hire. So I was motivating, image building, life lessoning individuals, man, that were, you know, basically thrown away from society. So I did that throughout that my time running those businesses. So what I always feel like, and I always said that I was given lessons for life. So all I'm doing now is just transferring it to people that can relate to it and, you know, give people an opportunity to be able to win on a high level, because that's what it's all about. You know, more wins than losses, you know?
Well, I know a documentary is in the works right now.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we got that going.
So that's going. And John and I had talked about, but the book is it's inevitable. The book has to come.
Okay. And
I believe that the screenplay for the actual movie, like the motion picture, not just a documentary, is going to hit.
Put it in the universe, brother.
And man, I want to tell you how much it meant to me, because people see the public persona yes. of you. They see, I mean, literally the godfather of the music that I love, that the whole country love. They see that part. I got to see a guy who said, I'll be there in 10 minutes. Give me 10 minutes to go up to my room and to be able to sit with you at dinner and have a real conversation with my friend, as opposed to,
yes.
I want to thank you for that.
No, but because like I said, so this is the thing that I tell people, I know what I know. I know what I know about everything. I know what I know about moves. I know what I know about businesses. I know what I know about people. And I knew when I knew that you were a good dude. And that's why I said, I go, and I will go outside the box when I know. And so normally my mode of operandi, because I am a private person, much like Guy O'Brien is a super private person. Master G is a public person, but Guy O'Brien is a private person. So once I get off that stage, I'm Guy O'Brien again. So my Guy O'Brien is like, okay, I'm out. I'm done. You got what you wanted. I gave it to you and tenfold. This is the greatest experience of your life, all of that. But now I'm done. So I'll see you on the next one. But I come outside my box when I know what I know. And I knew you had good, your energy was right. So that's why I said, as long as you could just give me a few minutes to recharge and get my mind right, I'll be there. And that's why we ended up, you know, clicking. And that's why it's happening. Because if you weren't, if your energy wasn't right, boss, I would have rolled on you. I'd have been like, yeah, okay, nah, tonight's not a good night.
Well, I appreciate it. And you made a dream of mine come true. I actually got, for those of you listening, if you didn't get a chance to go to Secret Knock, Master G performed Rapper's Delight, and he kept me on stage, and I actually got to rap with him, which my lyrics were off. But I tell you, like, my heart, my soul was with you. I started the podcast, G, because my two kids, Maddox and McKenna. Maddox is 12 years old. McKenna's 15. Okay. I wanted to take iconic people like yourself and show my kids that there's no idols in life to worship, only icons to be inspired by. And you are one of them.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. That's nice. That's very nice.
What advice would you have for Maddox and McKenna? And if you could use both their names and say Uncle G, that would be awesome.
So Maddox and McKenna, this is Uncle G. Okay? This is what I'm going to say to you. I want you to always, always, always understand that in life, there's highlights and hurdles, okay? And if you can create more highlights and overcome the hurdles, you're going to be all right. And you got to stay focused, disciplined, focused, and develop a program that you can maintain, because the ultimate thing is consistency. Consistency is the key.
G, I believe that honestly, you're going to be one of the most sought after speakers in the world. And
I'm working on it.
I'm telling you. And we're going to have the links in the bio. I'm going to have all those things to make sure that you can book, to be able to book, whether it be, I mean, but have G at your events. This man is absolutely phenomenal. I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
Yes.
And I'm going to ask you, because we're going to be friends for our lives at some point.
Yes.
I want you on again.
I'm on anytime you call. Not on again. You call me. I'm there. Like I said, I know what I know. I know, homeboy. Don't worry about it. You just call. I'm there. I love you.
I love you too. You're officially off the hot seat.
All right, buddy.